أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. Welcome to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. I am your host, Bill Whitehouse, and my Sufi friends call me Anab. I have been traveling sometimes more quickly and sometimes much more slowly on the Sufi path for over 40 years. I am not a Sufi sheikh, but I would like to use the contents of this podcast as a means of sharing with you some thoughts, ideas, possibilities, values, and principles concerning the Sufi spiritual way. Each edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will feature various selections concerning poetry, essays, readings from traditional sources, and reflections that give expression to different dimensions of the Sufi path. In addition, there also will be several musical interludes included that offer a change of pace of sorts. So relax, melt into the comfort of your chair, close your eyes, and permit me to take you on an excursion through some of the unrestricted regions of the Sufi spiritual path.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Malik Yawm Al-Din, Iyaka Na'budu Wa Iyaka Nasta'in, Ihdina Al-Sirat Al-Mustaqim, صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Owner of the Day of Judgment. Thee alone we worship, Thee alone we ask for help. Show us the straight path, the path of those whom thou hast favored, not the path of those who earn thine anger, nor of those who go astray.
The foregoing recitation was by Qari Wahid Zafar Kasmi. It is Surah 1, the opening. There is no surah of the Quran that is more recited by Muslims around the world than the opening. The surah is repeated in every rakat or cycle for each of the five daily prayers. In very concise, easy-to-remember terms, the surah gives expression to principles that go to the heart of Islam. For instance, in the surah, we are reminded that God is first and foremost, eternally beneficent as well as merciful. And furthermore, notwithstanding the ego's or nafs' inclinations to think otherwise, all praise is due to Allah, and there is no world or level of being which does not come under divine authority, including the Day of Judgment. In addition, the surah reminds us that there is no one who is worthy of worship but God, and there is no source of assistance except God. God alone is capable of guiding us to and keeping us on the right path, the way of those whom God has blessed with an abundance of favors. Only God can save us from ourselves and prevent us from going astray.
Thank you.
God willing, my intention is to release the Sufi Study Circle podcast between sunset on Thursday evening and sunset on Friday. I have given myself 24 degrees of freedom with respect to the time of release because life often has a way of interfering with schedules that are wound too tight. Friday is an auspicious day for Islam, as well as Tasawwuf, or the Sufi mystical path. For instance, Thursday evening, or Friday morning in lunar terms, is a time when Sufi groups assemble in different localities around the world. Moreover, Friday is the day when Muslims gather for the midday prayer and a khutbah or sermon is given prior to those prayers. I have given the title Friday Thoughts to this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast. Friday Thoughts does not follow the format of a khutbah, and yet, like a khutbah, it seeks to give expression to an array of ideas, values, and principles that are meant to be shared with those who are listening. Words that are intended to echo in the hearts, souls, and beings of attendees throughout the rest of the day, if not the following week and perhaps beyond. The themes of Friday thoughts will be varied. However, God willing, they will reflect a Sufi perspective. The title of today's Friday Thoughts is The God Virus. Approximately 6 years ago, Daryl W. Ray wrote a book entitled The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture. The title is relatively fatuous, that is, silly and pointless. Since one could have submitted a great many words for God and religion and said something equally provocative, ambiguous, and argumentative. For example, the title of the book could have been, quote, The Science Virus, How Technical Information Infects Our Lives and Culture, end of quote. Or, quote, The Philosophy Virus, How Thinking Infects Our Lives and Culture, end of quote. Or perhaps the title could have been, The Government Virus, How Politics Infects Our Lives and Culture, end of quote. And finally, the title might have been, quote, The Education Virus, How Schooling Infects Our Lives and Culture, end of quote. There are many problems that permeate science, philosophy, politics, and education, as well as religion. And all these problems often seem to propagate themselves in a viral-like manner that has the potential to destructively affect the lives of millions of people, as well as problematically shape the properties of many cultural institutions. And yet, one is inclined to feel that all such titles tend to cast too broad a net to capture much of value. The problem is not God and religion per se, any more than the problem is science and technical information, or philosophy and thinking, government and politics, or education and schooling per se. The real problem is what goes on in the minds, hearts, and souls of certain individuals as such activities impact the lives of other people in constructive or destructive ways. If Dr. Ray or anyone else wishes to argue that the manner in which some individuals engage the idea of God and or religion leads all too frequently to considerable harm and tragedy, then such observers won't get an argument from me concerning their claims, any more than they would get an argument from me if those commentators were to make similar critical comments concerning how the manner in which certain people engage science, philosophy, politics, and education leads, all too frequently, to considerable harm and tragedy manifesting themselves in the lives of other individuals. However, Dr. Ray does not appear to be interested in treating his subject matter with some degree of balanced equanimity. Instead, he seems intent on trying to argue that God and religion are inherently evil, that they are part of a parasitic disease process that constitutes a clear and present danger to the health of both human beings and civilization in general. Dr. Ray states that, quote, religious dogma, habit, beliefs, or guilt may affect you in ways you may not recognize, end of quote. One could just as easily state that scientific, philosophical, political, and educational, quote, dogma, habit, beliefs, or guilt may affect you in ways you may not recognize, end of quote. According to the aforementioned author, his book has been inspired by the work of, among others, Richard Dawkins, who introduced the idea of, quote, viruses of the mind, end of quote, in relation to issues involving God and religion. Dr. Ray, however, wants to build on the work of Dawkins by indicating how much mental viruses operate in the midst of everyday life. For instance, he believes that the mental virus paradigm can account for the existence of fundamentalism in this or that family member, or can account for why this or that minister, rabbi, priest, guru, Buddhist teacher, and so on, engages in sexual abuse of his or her parishioners, or can explain why someone would be willing to blow himself or herself up in a crowded Baghdad market. I wonder if the paradigm being alluded to by Dr. Ray can explain why individuals who are driven by this or that fanatical view of economics, whether communist, socialist, or capitalistic, are willing to impose devastation upon millions of people in order to satisfy the tenets of their economic dogmas, or explain why scientists insist that they have the right to explore and invent whatever they like without having to take responsibility for the destructive ramifications of their discoveries upon the rest of society, or why Western governments feel they have the right to destabilize, if not ruin, countries around the world in order to advance the agenda of corporations, or why members of Congress would be willing to pass legislation such as the Patriot Act, which they haven't even read. Dr. Ray has received a doctorate in education, yet he seems oblivious to how reductionistic, simplistic, and problematic his mental virus paradigm is. Do some people misunderstand and misapply various facets of religion? Sure they do, but this is also true with respect to the way many people problematically understand and apply politics, technology, education, philosophy, science, law, and economics. One can identify the nature of the common theme running through the issues, religious and otherwise, confronting human beings by looking in the mirror. The central problem is not God or religion or any other idea, but rather the source of humanity's difficulties lies within each of us. Dr. Ray wants to wag his finger and cluck his tongue at God and religion in a disapproving manner. Never for a second does he appear to consider the possibility that his understanding of things might be part of the problem. Human beings are complex creatures. They are beset with a conflicting array of anxieties, fears, doubts, desires, hopes, concerns, jealousies, beliefs, ideas, hatreds, needs, possibilities, uncertainties, likes, dislikes, informational claims, weaknesses, strengths, abilities, interests, talents, physical issues and opportunities, as well as an array of familial, community, institutional, historical, and national influences. The impact of the foregoing array of themes with respect to shaping and coloring the contours of lived life often play a substantial role in determining how one engages the idea of God and religion, as well as the ideas of politics, economics, education, society, law, philosophy, and science. Our ideas about God and religion are, to some extent, as much a function of the many forces impinging on us and running through our consciousness, individually and collectively, as the latter forces are a function of the religious filters through which they are processed. Dr. Ray indicates that, quote, some very scary people are preaching hatred and intolerance, end of quote. And he proceeds to quote from a number of religious leaders to support his contention. He says very little, if anything, about how many political, legal, military, educational, financial, media, scientific, and corporate leaders are preaching their own forms of enmity and intolerance to advance agendas that have the same kind of destructive impact on people as will the allegedly religious people whom Dr. Ray quotes. Supposedly, according to Dr. Ray, one can run experiments that demonstrate how every prophetic religion involves the presence of a God virus that undermines a person's capacity for critical thought. Or, more precisely, according to Dr. Ray, the nature of prophetic religions is such that they enhance an individual's capacity to be able to critique the splinters in the eyes of other religious traditions while remaining blind with respect to the beams in their own spiritual orientation. Actually, the problem to which Dr. Ray alludes is not restricted to religious circles. It is a problem that is present in any kind of ideological activity that seeks to point out how all other systems of ideas are inferior relative to one's own ideological perspective. Indeed, Dr. Ray occupies himself with pointing out the many failings of this or that religious perspective, while he fails to critically analyze his own claims. He describes how religion is capable of commandeering a person's capacity for critical thought, and yet any system of thought is capable of doing this if an individual permits it, and Dr. Ray has permitted a non-religious ideology to commandeer his own capacity for critical thought. Dr. Ray claims that neurological experiments have demonstrated that spiritual experiences can be generated through electrical and chemical stimulation of the brain. He further argues that Dr. Timothy Leary's experiments with LSD and the use of peyote by certain Native American peoples has proven that mystical experiences are nothing more than a function of the way the brain reacts to various forms of stimulation. Actually, Dr. Ray is a tad premature in the manner in which he equates chemical stimulation of the brain with mystical experiences. If someone ingests peyote or LSD or any number of other possibilities and then experiences some sort of altered state of consciousness, has that person necessarily had a mystical experience? Doesn't one first have to establish a baseline for what constitutes a mystical experience? Doesn't one also have to be able to establish whether it might be possible to have an altered state of consciousness that is not necessarily mystical in nature? Or is any episode of drunken delirium tremens in which a person believes he or she is conversing with God or the devil to count as a mystical experience? If one likes, one can interpret or filter an altered state of consciousness through spiritual lenses. However, this does not mean that such an experience necessarily reflects or gives expression to some truth that exists independently of one's interpretational framework. Have experiments been done in which the brains of individuals were stimulated in one way or another, and such stimulation resulted in an altered state of consciousness? That is, an experience or set of experiences which is of a non-ordinary nature? Yes, such experiments have been conducted, but it is anyone's guess as to what the actual significance of those experiences is. Some people are less epistemologically cautious than they should be when they label chemically based experiments as being mystical or spiritual in nature. Other individuals, such as Dr. Ray, are less epistemologically cautious than they should be when they try to equate chemically based experiences with the possibility of mystical events. According to Dr. Ray, once an individual undergoes a conversion experience, then having a rational discussion about the irrational dimensions of such an orientation becomes next to impossible to accomplish. While acknowledging the possibility that the experience of religious conversion might not be what the person undergoing such an experience believes is the case, namely, that she or he has come in direct contact with absolute reality in some sense, nonetheless, similar problems arise in conjunction with almost any experience or set of experiences that have a profound impact on a person's ideas about reality. In other words, once a person commits to a particular point of view, such an individual often becomes quite defensive about and resistant to anyone beginning to raise questions concerning the rational tenability of this or that aspect of that sort of a commitment. One could substitute politics, science, philosophy, economics, psychology, athletics, law, drugs, sex, and the individual who has undergone some sort of associated conversion experience will tend to become uneasy when someone comes along and begins to suggest that the basis of one's commitments to this or that perspective, religious or non-religious, seems rather irrational. Among many other things, Dr. Ray seems to fail to grasp the possibility that requiring human experience and reality to answer to the tenets of rationality is itself a possibly irrational perspective. After all, we don't know what the nature of reality is or what makes such a reality possible, so why automatically assume that reality can be fully and properly parsed or probed by the principles of rationality? Moreover, people's definition of what constitutes rationality often tends to be little more than a reflection of their own beliefs concerning the nature of reality. Indeed, quite frequently for many individuals, anything that strays from one's adopted perspective is considered ipso facto to be irrational in nature. We often ask ourselves how someone could possibly believe this or that idea, or how someone possibly could consider a given belief to be rational. Yet the obstacles to achieving such an understanding are, all too frequently, a function of the structure, limits, and properties of our own beliefs, and might have little or nothing to do with the actual tenability or degree of rationality or irrationality of someone else's point of view. In his book, Dr. Ray describes a journey that took him from 1. Growing up in a fundamentalist religious environment, 2. Attending a religiously based undergraduate program, and 3. Obtaining some advanced degree at institutions that were shaped to some degree by a certain religious perspective. He further indicates that he converted from a religious perspective to an agnostic position when he was in his 30s, before becoming a full-fledged atheist by the time he was 40. Isn't it possible that Dr. Ray has allowed his own life journey to shape his ideas about religious and non-religious issues? Isn't it possible that Dr. Ray has permitted his own conversion to atheism to filter, color, and shape the way he looks at religion? Isn't it possible that Dr. Ray's commitment to an atheistic orientation renders him emotionally, conceptually, and evidentially resistant to any possibility suggesting that the basis of his atheism might not be as sound as he supposes? Isn't it possible that someone might come along and critically examine Dr. Ray's process of going from religious belief to first agnosticism and then atheism, and in the process point out the many irrationalities that might characterize such a journey and conversion process? Isn't it possible that Dr. Ray might become defensive when various decisions made during his life journey were exposed to critical examination and the point made that however well considered he feels his decisions were concerning this or that religious tradition, nonetheless, there might be many things that Dr. Ray failed to consider during his decision process. I've gone through my own experiences of spiritual abuse, and therefore, to a degree, I do understand many of the issues that surround and permeate the sorts of life experiences encountered by someone like Dr. Ray during his journey from religious belief to atheism. However, just because my experience with one allegedly religious group might have been problematic, this doesn't make all talk of religion and God to be necessarily irrational or resistant to being probed, to whatever extent this is possible, through rational forms of analysis. In many ways, the content of Dr. Ray's book seems to indicate that he went in search of experiential data that was consistent with his conversion to atheism, just as many people often go in search of experiential data that is consistent with a conversion to this or that religious perspective. Dr. Ray considers his conversion process to be an entirely rational endeavor and one that makes sense to him, just as those who undergo a religious conversion feel that everything they are experiencing, feeling, and thinking about with respect to their lives carries its own sense of justified meaning and purpose. As indicated previously within the pages of The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, Dr. Ray doesn't appear to engage in a process of questioning his own ideas, theories, claims, beliefs, and values to the same extent, if at all, that he does with respect to an array of religious ideas, theories, claims, beliefs, and values. His discussion seems skewed by a set of non-religious values and principles that he does not apply to his own perspective in any sort of rigorously critical manner. There is much that can be justifiably criticized in the realm of religion. However, there is also much that can be justifiably criticized in the realm of the non-religious as well. The issue should not be whether or not something is religious or non-religious. The issue should be to what extent does that something give expression to the truth, and how does one go about trying to determine what is and is not true, to whatever extent this can be done. Dr. Ray argues that, quote, virtually all religions rely upon early childhood indoctrination as the prime infection strategy. Other infectious strategies include proselytizing, providing educational opportunities to religious institutions, and so on. Almost all parents seek to instill their values and beliefs, whether religious or non-religious, in their children. And therefore, indoctrination of one kind or another is not an activity that is restricted to just religious families. Dr. Ray's book, The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, gives expression to a process of proselytizing in which he seeks to persuade his readers to adopt his point of view and abandon anything that hints of religious commitment or to reinforce a non-religious point of view. Furthermore, many non-religious people attempt to shape the minds and hearts of other people through educational opportunities, just as religious people do. It is foolish for Dr. Ray to criticize the religiously inclined with respect to their tactics of indoctrination, proselytizing, and using educational opportunities to infect people with the virus of religiosity. This point is especially relevant to the discussion taking place in his book, as he ignores the fact that he himself is engaged in a similar sort of activity, since he seeks to infect people with his own non-religious ideas, feelings, and beliefs. At one point in his book, Dr. Ray states, quote, "When a religion infects a person, that is, a host in biological terms, it immediately begins creating antibodies against competing viruses," end of quote. As a result, according to Dr. Ray, people rarely switch to a religion that is different from the one into which they were initiated as children. I grew up in a Christian environment. I went to Sunday school on a regular basis, and I was fairly active in the denominational church that I attended. Growing up, I think I had a relatively brief contact with one boy who was Jewish and whose family lived in our town for a short while before moving on. And as well, I had limited contact with a boy that belonged to the Church of the Latter-day Saints. I was the best friend of the son of my next-door neighbor, and I never knew whether my friend had any religious beliefs or attended any kind of religious institution. The topic never came up. I never asked about it. I knew little or nothing about Islam during my formative years. Perhaps the closest I came to Islam was through some of the movies that featured characters drawn from the 1001 Tales of the Arabian Nights. I started university with the idea of becoming a minister. Although John Harvard founded the university I attended and did so for purposes of providing young men with an opportunity for acquiring a sound but religiously oriented form of higher education, Harvard is hardly an institution that seeks to indoctrinate people into becoming Christians, nor do they proselytize Christianity, but instead, like any good liberal college, they offer an array of different points of view, both religious and non-religious. Neither my parents, nor the people in my immediate neighborhood, nor my grammar school, nor my Sunday school, nor any of the sermons that I attended indoctrinated me to reject Judaism, the Church of the Latter-day Saints, or my next-door friend who turned out to be an atheist. My father believed in God, but he was not someone who attended church. However, he supported my mother in whatever way he could, which included, among other things, showing up for Christmas Eve services and driving my mother to and from the church to which she belonged for whatever events or activities might be taking place in connection with her commitment to that congregation. The foregoing religious differences between my mother and father were on obvious display within many aspects of family life. However, those differences were never discussed, at least not with me. I accompanied my mother to church. My older brother did not attend church. I can't remember any occasion when I was growing up which I voiced the question, "How come I have to go to church but my older brother does not?" Everyone within the family seemed to go in his or her own preferred direction when it came to religious orientation. Many of my friends who lived in another part of the town in which I grew up were Catholic. I was not. My mother let me hang out with those kids. She also permitted me to attend Mass with them on several occasions. I had no idea about the religious affiliation of any of the people in my immediate neighborhood. All I knew is that they didn't attend the same church that I did. The first Muslim that I knowingly met was an inmate at a private psychiatric facility where I was working between my third and fourth year of university. Since he kept to himself pretty much, I never really talked with him. I knew next to nothing about Islam when I came in contact with the person who would become my spiritual guide. I had read a few Western takes on the Sufi path, but these books were often caught up talking about spiritual powers and mystical visions, so Islam itself got lost in the shuffle. I have no doubt, especially today, that there are many families, neighborhoods, places of worship, and schools that take a dim view of anything other than their own brand of spirituality, and this holds true across spiritual traditions. Nevertheless, I also know there are many families, neighborhoods, places of worship, and schools that seek to promote interfaith dialogue, tolerance, harmony, and spiritual cooperation. I know the latter statement is true because I grew up under such conditions. Furthermore, I don't think I am the only person to go through such a set of life circumstances, because there have been millions of people who grew up within the context of one religious tradition and then at some point in their life converted to another, seemingly quite different spiritual tradition. If the processes of indoctrination and proselytizing were as complete and pervasive as Dr. Ray tries to suggest in his book, I don't believe there would have been as much movement across spiritual lines as has occurred during the last 50 to 60 years. One also might keep in mind that among those who appear to have become most strident in their attempts to indoctrinate and proselytize others are people such as Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daryl Ray, and the recently deceased Christopher Hitchens, who claim that they are only attempting to defend their own view of things through their talks and writings, but often do so with a great deal of unnecessary and unhelpful negativity towards anything of a religious nature. It is like what politicians do in relation to negative advertising. Since those politicians can't convincingly show that what they believe is true or constitutes a viable solution to social problems, then they often adopt the strategy of trying to paint their opponents, in this case religious believers, as hypocrites, irrational fools, indoctrinated parasites, and delusional mental cases. Some people seem to believe that such techniques of negative advertising concerning those who are religiously inclined prove that atheism is right. After all, if one can point out errors and inconsistencies in the thinking and writing of this or that religiously inclined individual, then surely this constitutes a form of proof that supports the claim of atheists. Nothing could be further from the truth. If atheists want to win the day, so to speak, then they must advance arguments that conclusively demonstrate that God does not exist, and atheists can't do this. All they can do is point out possible errors and mistakes in the thinking and writing of this or that religiously oriented individual. Many atheists point to the discoveries of science as indicating that we live in a natural world that operates in accordance with the principles that have been uncovered by science. However, if one pursues such matters with any degree of rigorous detail, then neither evolution, physics, or neurobiology is capable of accounting for the origins of the universe or life or consciousness, intelligence, memory, reason, logic, language, creativity, or talent. At best, such negative advertising might or might not constitute a legitimate criticism involving the beliefs of a particular person. At worst, such tactics do little more than demonstrate to an array of people that non-religious individuals who become preoccupied with such techniques of negative advertising and propaganda are really not all that different from the hateful, bigoted fundamentalists of whatever spiritual orientation whom they love to rail against and quote. If someone believes that atheism constitutes a true reflection of reality, then that person should state the case for atheism. Becoming bogged down in a campaign of negative advertising against this or that religiously inclined individual does nothing to constructively advance the cause of atheists. If someone wishes to be an atheist, then that is her or his choice. If someone wishes to be a Christian, Taoist, Jew, Buddhist, Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, or adopt some form of native spirituality, then that is a person's choice. I am not God, and I have no idea how any of this will work out for others or myself. God, assuming divinity exists, and I do assume this, can accept or reject anyone divinity likes. Exploring issues of rationality, consistency, evidence, science, and the like is one thing. However, starting such a process of exploration with biases about what constitutes rationality, consistency, evidence, and science is another matter altogether. and this remains true irrespective of whether those biases are religious or non-religious in nature. From the outback of Australia to the rainforests of South America, from the frozen tundra of Siberia to the plains of Serengeti, from the Himalayas of Asia to the white cliffs of Dover, from the geysers of Yosemite to the glaciers of Antarctica, you are listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. Poetry is a form of communication that, when done well, seeps into one's mind, heart, and soul, resonating with one's being long after the spoken words have evaporated into the vastness of space. Yet every poem is vulnerable to the possibility of being distorted by the emotional and conceptual filters through which it is received. Moreover, although the foregoing vulnerability is present even when a poem is not translated from another language, the presence of translation opens up the possibility of considerable distortion entering into the way in which the underlying sense of a poem is engaged. Poetry is often filled with allusions, nuances, subtexts, idioms, similes, metaphors, and wordplay that don't necessarily remain intact when revealed within the context of another language. Just as the Quran cannot be reduced to how a given individual translates its meanings, so too Sufi poetry often does not travel intact from one language to another. Thus, for example, what was actually intended in a given passage of Rumi's original text might or might not be captured accurately, partially or wholly, by the way in which a given individual translates such a passage. Every edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will contain poetry that is attributed to this or that Sufi poet. Usually such poetry will give expression to someone's translation of an original text that is written in a language other than English. Rather than trying to claim that, for instance, Rumi meant this or that in a given passage of poetry, especially one that is translated, one might fare better if one did not consider such a passage of poetry as necessarily constituting an authoritative representation of what a given poet, for instance Rumi, believed or understood or meant by such a passage. Instead, take the poetry as an opportunity to enter into a process of critical reflection and exploration concerning oneself and one's own relationship with divinity. Something is true not because someone, Rumi or anyone else, said it. Something is true because it reflects the way things are in some given context or on some given level of being. And poets are often held in esteem because they were able, by the grace of God, to reflect some dimension of that truth in an artful manner. The Sufi poets are leaving behind remnants in their words that are rooted in the phenomenology of a spiritual journey that seeks to travel in the direction of a truth that transcends all words. Use poetry as a point of disembarkation of sorts concerning such a journey. Let the words of a poem induce one to search for the truth, to embrace those words as reminders, filtered though they might be by the perspective of a translator or a listener, that there is a truth for which to search, and that there exists a reality that is waiting to be realized in one's life according to one's spiritual capacity and God's grace. The following poem is from the Mathnawi of Maulana Jalaluddin Muhammad Rumi, translated and abridged by E. H. Winfield. That person one night was crying, O Allah, that his mouth might be sweetened thereby. And Satan said to him, Be quiet, O austere one, how long wilt thou babble, O man of many words? No answer comes to thee from nigh the throne. How long wilt thou cry, Allah, with harsh face? That person was sad at heart and hung his head, and then beheld Khizr present before him in a vision, who said to him, Ah, thou hast ceased to call on God. Wherefore repentest thou of calling upon him? The man said, The answer, Here am I, came not. Wherefore I fear that I am repulsed from the door. Khizr replied to him, God has given me this command. Go to him and say, O much tried one, did not I engage thee to do my service? Did not I engage thee to call upon me? That calling Allah of thine was my here I am, and that pain and longing and ardor of thine my messenger? Thy struggles and strivings for assistance were my attractions, and originated the prayer. Thy fear and thy love are the covert of my mercy. Each, O Lord, of thine contains many, here am I. The soul of fools is alien from this calling on God, because it is not their wont to cry, O Lord. On their mouths and hearts are locks and bonds, that they may not cry to God in time of distress. God gave Pharaoh abundance of riches and wealth, so that he boasted that he was Lord Supreme. In the whole of his life he suffered no headache, so that he never cried to God, rich that he was. God granted him the absolute dominion of the world, but withheld from him pain and sorrow and cares, because pain and sorrow and loads of cares are the lot of God's friends in the world. Pain is better than the dominion of the world, so that thou mayest call on God in secret. The cries of those free from pain are dull and cold. The cries of the sorrowful come from the burning hearts. The following traditional reading comes from the book Principles of Sufism by Al-Kushari, translated by B.R. von Schlegel.
Purity, safa, is an admirable attribute in every tongue, and its opposite, impurity, is blameworthy. Abu Hujaifa related, quote, The messenger of God, may God's blessings and peace be upon him, came out to us one day, his face drained of color, and said, quote, The earth's purity has vanished, and only impurity remains. Today death is a blessing for every Muslim, end of quote. The designation Sufi has become the common one for this group. Thus it is said of a man that he is a Sufi, and of the group as a whole that they are Sufia. The person who tries to become like one of them is called Mutasawif, and these people as a whole are called Mutasawifa. There is no etymology or analogy with another word in the Arabic language to be drawn from the name Sufi. The most plausible interpretation is that it is much like a surname. There are those who say that it comes from wool, suf. Thus, tasawuf is used for the wearing of wool, just as takamas is used for wearing a shirt. This is one possibility. But in fact, the Sufis are not distinguished by wearing wool. Others say that the Sufis are related to the men who sat on the bench, sufa, outside the mosque of the Messenger of God, may God's blessings and peace be upon him. But the adjective of sufa would not take the form Sufi. Another group says that it is derived from safa, purity. The derivation of Sufi from safa is unlikely from a linguistic point of view. Others say that it is derived from saf, row or rank, because the Sufis are in the foremost rank by virtue of their hearts. This is correct in meaning, but Sufi cannot be the adjective of saf. In conclusion, the group, the Sufis, are so well known that it is not necessary to find an analogy or a derivation for their designation. Everyone who speaks on the meaning of Sufism and who is called a Sufi speaks according to his own experience. To go into this matter at length would take me beyond my intention to be brief in this work. I will mention here some of the Sufi words on the subject in order to give a hint of their meanings, if God Most High wills. When Muhammad al-Jurairi was asked about Sufism, he explained, quote, "It means taking up every sublime moral characteristic and leaving behind every lowly one," end of quote. Al-Junaid said, quote, "Sufism means that God causes you to die to yourself and gives you life in Him," end of quote. Al-Hussein ibn Mansur, when asked about the Sufi, commented, quote, "He is solitary by nature. No one accepts him, and he accepts no one," end of quote. Abu Hamza al-Baghdadi said, quote, "The mark of the true Sufi is that he becomes poor after having been rich. He experiences abasement after having been held in high esteem, and he becomes unknown after having been famous. The mark of the false Sufi is that he becomes rich after having been poor. He becomes the object of high esteem after having been abased, and he becomes famous after having been unknown," end of quote. Amir bin Uthman al-Maki was asked about Sufism, and he asserted, quote, "It is that the servant acts according to whatever is most fitting to the moment," end of quote. Muhammad bin al-Kasab stated, quote, "Sufism consists of noble characteristics shown at a noble time by a noble man among noble people," end of quote. When asked about Sufism, Samnan said, quote, "It means that you possess nothing and nothing possesses you," end of quote. Ruwayam observed about Sufism, quote, "It means giving up the self to be with God in whatever manner God wishes," end of quote. Al-Junaid was asked about Sufism, and he declared, quote, "It is that you be solely with God with no attachments," end of quote. Ruwayam ibn Ahmad al-Baghdadi said, quote, "Sufism is founded on three traits, adhering to poverty and dependence on God, attaining the virtues of generosity and selfless giving, and abandoning resistance and choice," end of quote. Ma'ruf al-Khaki explained, quote, "Sufism is holding to hidden realities and severing hope from all that is in the hands of human beings," end of quote. Hamdan al-Qasar said, quote, "Befriend the Sufis, for they see reasons for excusing disagreeable acts, and they are not impressed with good deeds, to the point that they would think you great for performing them," end of quote. When asked about the adherents of Sufism, Al-Kharaz responded, quote, "They are a people who give until they experience expansion, who deprive themselves and lose everything. Then they are summoned by mysteries close unto them. Say, quote, arise, weep over us," end of quote. Al-Junaid said, quote, "Sufism is a war in which there is no peace," end of quote. He also said, quote, "The Sufis are members of a single household that none other than they can enter," end of quote. He also explained, quote, "Sufism is invocation of God together with inward concentration, ecstasy together with attentive hearing, and action combined with following the Sunnah," end of quote. Al-Junaid stated, quote, "The Sufi is like the earth. Every kind of abomination is thrown upon it, but not but every kind of goodness grows from it," end of quote. He also said, quote, "The Sufi is like the earth. Both the righteous human being and the sinner walk upon it. That person is like the clouds. They give shade to all things. That individual is like the raindrop. It waters all things," end of quote. He also remarked, "If you see a Sufi caring for his or her outer appearance, then know that his inward being is corrupt," end of quote. Saul ibn Abdallah commented, quote, "The Sufi is the one who would not object if his or her blood were shed and his or her property taken," end of quote. An-Nuri said, quote, "A sign of the Sufis is that the person is content when the individual has nothing, and that individual gives selflessly when that person has much," end of quote. Al-Qahtani asserted, quote, Sufism is good moral characteristics. Whoever surpasses you in good moral characteristics surpasses you in purity. End of quote. Abu Ali Ar-Rudbari said, quote, Sufism is staying at the lover's door even when you are driven away. End of quote. He also stated, quote, Sufism is the purity of nearness after the impurity of remoteness. End of quote. It is said, quote, the most odious thing of all is the miserly Sufi. End of quote. It is also said, quote, Sufism is an empty hand in a pure heart. End of quote. Ashudli observed, quote, Sufism is sitting with God without care. End of quote. Abu Mansur said, quote, the Sufi is one whose indication is from God Most High, for surely human beings indicate something of God. End of quote. Ashibli stated, quote, the Sufi is separated from mankind and united with God, as God says to Moses, quote, I have attached you to myself, and this is from the Quran, cutting him off from all else. Then he said to him, quote, you will never see me, end of quote, and this is also from the Quran. Ashibli also said, quote, the Sufis are children in the lap of God, end of quote. Quote, Sufism is a flaming flash of lightning, and, quote, Sufism is being protected from paying heed to creation, end of quote. Ruayyam declared, quote, the Sufis remain full of goodness as long as they quarrel with one another. As soon as they make peace, there is no good in them. Al-Jurairi said, quote, Sufism means maintaining a vigilant awareness over one's states and holding to correct behavior, end of quote. Al-Muzayyan asserted, quote, Sufism is submission to God, end of quote. Abu Turab an-Nakshabi remarked, quote, the Sufi is not made impure by anything, and by him all things are made pure, end of quote. It is said, quote, the search does not tire the Sufi, and worldly things do not annoy him, end of quote. When Dhul Nun al-Misri was asked about the Sufis, he answered, quote, they are a people who prefer God, glorious and majestic, over all things, and whom God prefers over all things, end of quote. Al-Wasiti, may God grant him mercy, said, quote, at first the Sufis were given clear indications, then these became only motions, and now naught remains but sorrow, end of quote. An-Nuri was asked about the Sufi, and he replied, quote, he is one who has heard the audition and who preferred the mandated causes of salvation, end of quote. Abu Nasr al-Sraj related, quote, I asked al-Husri, quote, who in your opinion is a Sufi? He responded, quote, the earth does not carry him, nor do the heavens shade him, end of quote. He refers here to the Sufi's effacement. It is said, quote, the Sufi is one who, when presented with two goodly states or two moral characteristics, takes the better of the two, end of quote. Ashibli was asked, quote, why are the Sufis called by this name? End of quote. He said, quote, it is because of the traces of the self that remain within them. If this were not the case, there would be no name attached to them, end of quote. Ibn al-Jallah was asked, quote, who is called a Sufi? End of quote. He answered, quote, we do not know that person by the conditions set in learning, but we know that that person is one who is poor, stripped of worldly causes. That individual is with God without being tied to a place, but God, may he be exalted, does not bar that person from knowing all places. This is the one called a Sufi. End of quote. One of the Sufis declared, quote, Sufism means a loss of dignity and rank and a blackening of the face in this world and in the hereafter, end of quote. Abu Yaqub al-Mazdabili explained, quote, Sufism is a state in which all human attributes fade away, end of quote. Abul al-Hasan As-Sewani said, quote, "The Sufi is the one who is concerned with inspired states, not with litanies and recitations," end of quote. The master, Abu Ali ad-Dakak, may God grant him mercy, said, quote, "The choicest thing that has been said on this matter is," quote, "This path is fit only for those persons whose spirits God has used to sweep the dunghills," end of quote. For this reason, Abu Ali stated one day, quote, "If the dervish had nothing left but his spirit and he offered it to the dogs at this door, not one dog would pay it any attention," end of quote. The master Abu Sal al-Suluki said, quote, "Sufism is turning away from inward objections to what God has decreed," end of quote. Al-Husri commented, quote, "The Sufi is not existent after that person's non-existence, nor is that individual non-existent after existence," end of quote. This point is not readily understood. When he says, quote, "The person is not existence after that individual's non-existence," end of quote, he means that after that person's defects have passed away, they do not return. When he says, quote, "Nor is that person non-existent after that individual's existence," end of quote, he means that if that individual is entirely oriented to God, that individual does not decline to the rank of mankind at large, so that worldly events have no effect on him. It is said, quote, "The Sufi is effaced in the flashes he receives from God," end of quote. It is said, quote, "The Sufi is overpowered by the flow of lordship and veiled by the demeanor of servitude," end of quote. It is also said, quote, "The Sufi does not change, but if he were to change, he would not grieve," end of quote. Al-Karaz related, quote, "I was in the Karyon Mosque on the day of a congregational prayer, and I saw a man going among the rows of worshippers saying, quote, 'Show me charity, for I was a Sufi, and now I have become weak and feeble,'" end of quote. "So I offered him some alms, and he told to me, quote, 'Leave me be, woe unto you, this is not what I seek,'" end of quote, and he would not take the alms.
Over the years, and by the grace of Allah, thousands of my books have been purchased by people, as well as a few libraries, located in 20 to 25 countries around the world, from Senegal to Norway, Australia, Japan, Mexico, Brazil, England, Denmark, Germany, South Africa, New Zealand, and more. It might sound impressive, but if I had to live off the proceeds from such books, I would have perished a long time ago had not God found other means of financial support for me. Individually, the books cost anywhere from $7.95 to $25. If a person were to buy the entire collection of books in a real-world format, or even in a virtual format, one would have to spend somewhere around $300. Relatively recently, I have put together a software package that contains the entire collection of the 33 books that, up to the present time, have been issued through me. In addition, I have added 33 pieces of floetry, that is, poems combining rhythm, rhyme, and music, some of which have been featured in the Sufi Study Circle podcast, that if purchased via CD would cost another $20 or so, as well as I have included a number of videos, one of which appears on a DVD that previously was released to the public and goes for around $13. The foregoing software package is priced at $19.95. This constitutes a saving of over $300 when calculated in terms of the cost of the items contained within the software package had they been purchased individually. The software package is entitled Sufi Reflections. If you are interested in obtaining a copy of the software package for $19.95, please go to http://anab-whitehouse.com for further information. I don't know of any other person within the Muslim community, at least in North America and perhaps beyond, who has released such an array of diverse, high-quality writings. The topics range from 9/11 to Sharia, psychology, evolution, education, political science, constitutional law, quantum physics, spiritual abuse, cosmology, mysticism, leadership, Islam, moral philosophy, mythology, and history. There is a great deal of food for thought in the foregoing material that is of relevance to and perhaps value for the Muslim community. I might not have all the answers or even any of them. Nonetheless, the aforementioned software package, Sufi Reflections, should, God willing, induce a person to reconsider a great many ideas. I'm not trying to reinvent or reinterpret the Islamic spiritual tradition. Instead, I am trying to draw attention to a variety of issues, ideas, and problems that might adversely affect the way an individual engages Islam. Although I do not have the talent or spiritual stature of Rumi, Hafiz, or even my own spiritual guide, may God be pleased with them all, nevertheless, from time to time, the impetus to write poetry has arisen within me. I have joined such efforts to various musical backgrounds, produced a combination of rhythm, rhyme, and musical overtones that I refer to as floetry, which, in a way, sort of harkens back to the beat generation of the late 1940s and early 1950s, when individuals would recite their poetical compositions against the backdrop of the improvised offerings of a group of jazz musicians that shared the stage with the poet. Some of the poems that will appear in this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast are inspired by life events of my own, while other poems are rooted in the teachings of great spiritual luminaries of the past. In the latter case, I have run someone else's understanding through the filters of my own limitations, but have tried as best I can to retain the spirit of the ideas and sensibilities that were given expression through the original poems or prose of some great Sufi of the past. Today's edition of Floetry is entitled Muhammad, Peace Be Upon Him. Quran described Muhammad as just a man. While this is true, this is like saying glass is sand. The latter is lowly, opaque, and needs to be subjected to fire so as to gain the degree of purity to which, God willing, one might see the truth of what is visible through life's window. A glassmaker took the potential of a clay lump, twisting and twirling it, or some say, a day, between two fingers of mercy as it became a jewel of beauty to which creation came via the breath of Kun, and began to proclaim the message of how to become the mirror's tane. Die before you die, he said, was a central seed to instill in our hearts. Indeed, this was a deed that might become a selfless plant of piety, from which fruits of love, prayer, faith, and sincerity would burst forth as blessings for all humanity if we're ready to abandon hypocrisy. He counseled us to pray without ceasing, to be perpetually recalling divinity, to realize the needs for deep humility and modesty before the Lord of Majesty, to know that the root of all prayers requires one to renounce the world of delusion for the one. He is reported to have said, we are asleep, and when we die, we awake from the haunting deep dream of life as we come to intimately know there is no reality but God, that we owe everything to divinity, the one who sows more blessings into our lives than oceans have drops. He has warned us that we may reflect on all things, but not on Allah's essence, for this surely brings nothing but ignorance and arrogance to minds and hearts that depart from the clearly given signs concerning human capacity, and inclines one towards the whispered sweet nothings of deviltry. If you love your Creator, then love creation first. Are words of value for people of station simple and complex, since faith's completion will not take place till we love one another as He taught. Belief won't be perfected unless we have sought sincerely for others what we wish for ourselves. He has told us the Quran has an outer sense, yet also has levels of hidden meanings. Hence, one should not be too quick to dismiss mysteries that may only be known by those servants who see by the light of God to the depths of being seen, and carry back to the beach dwellers pearls of grace. This portion of the Sufi Study Circle podcast involves a brief essay or commentary on topics of importance to everyday life. Every point of the Sufi mystical path is commensurate with principles and values that have practical ramifications for lived life, since the primary measure of practicality will, to one degree or another, always be a function of the truth. Real pragmatism must be rooted in an understanding concerning the forces that impinge on our lives, both from within and without. The essays or commentaries of this segment of the program are intended to probe different dimensions of everyday life from a Sufi perspective. This week's edition of the Meditative Essay section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is entitled Humility. Humility is not exactly a growth industry in today's world. However, Sufi masters maintain this quality is of fundamental importance to the mystical path. Humility is both a fruit of the path as well as a key which, God willing, opens the door to further possibilities of spiritual growth during the mystical journey. Nonetheless, One does not seek humility as a means to something else. Humility has an intrinsic spiritual worth. To varying degrees, most of us are lacking in humility. There are different reasons for this. Some of this relative deficiency in humility is due to the times in which we live. From a very early age, many of us are taught, both within our families and in schools, to be somewhat aggressive and assertive in promoting ourselves. Being able to impress other people helps create opportunities. We have to let other people know whom we are and what we can do. As long as one can deliver, as long as one can back up the self-promotion with competence, skill, talent, and intelligence, then a certain amount of cocky confidence is considered by our society as not only acceptable, but admirable, if not necessary. Such confidence is thought to be an important ingredient in the quest for success and accomplishment. On the other hand, too much of this self-promotional assertiveness becomes annoying and often is counterproductive. It rubs people the wrong way and generates friction, conflict, and animosity. To grasp the boundaries of propriety in this area of self-promotion, not to mention the more difficult challenge of acquiring humility, can be a trying and humbling affair. Many hard lessons concerning self-promotion and humility have to be digested during the socialization process involving family, friends, school, and work. Unfortunately, the problems of learning how to live within the boundaries of propriety or learning the more demanding qualities of humility is exacerbated by many aspects of modern life. For example, all too many professional athletes, television and movie stars, recording artists, cultural icons, and politicians think of arrogance and self-centeredness as virtues. Indeed, relative to many of these people who don't seem to know the meaning of propriety, mere cocky self-confidence would seem like the essence of humility itself. The quote-unquote example being set by some of these paragons of excess and braggadocio is having an increasingly devastating impact on grade schools, high schools, colleges, and universities. The atmosphere they help to create is conducive to the breeding of all manner of arrogance, pride, and conceit in the minds and hearts of those who worship at the altar of their idols. Power, money, fame, talent, and intelligence have a way of eating away at the line separating a certain degree of self-confidence and the slippery slope of pride. However, we all have the potential to cross this line, even if our circumstances should be entirely modest and without, for example, celebrity status of any kind. The Sufi masters speak of the Pharaoh within each of us. This is our tendency towards feeling superior to others. The Pharaoh within us is naturally inclined to a sense of self-importance and operates according to the belief it has a right to be self-indulgent, self-centered, and vain. Our Pharaoh considers itself to have an exalted place in the scheme of things, no matter how small the desert may be in which it reigns supreme. Occupying such a lofty place entitles us, so our Pharaoh believes, to treat other people with contempt and disrespect. Conversely, our Pharaoh does not tolerate being on the receiving end of contempt or disrespect from anyone else. Much of the quote-unquote dissing phenomenon that is current and leads to so many ugly confrontations is an expression of what happens when Pharaoh meets Pharaoh. According to the practitioners of the Sufi path, each of us is charged with the task of Prophet Moses, peace be upon him. We must convey the message of God to our Pharaohs, both collectively and individually, to let our people go. We must struggle with our Pharaohs in order to journey towards the promised land of humility. To achieve humility is, by the grace of God, to be modest in all things and to give deference and veneration to others. Humility is about having no expectation towards others concerning what is due to one. Moreover, when one is wronged or dealt with unjustly, one is gentle, mild, and forbearing in response. Humility is to prefer others to oneself. Humility is to have an heartfelt respect for the essential worth of all human beings as well
as all of creation. Humility is a matter of being ready to yield to the wishes of others and knowing when this yielding is appropriate to do with respect to the requirements of spiritual etiquette. Humility is filled with the wisdom of understanding the rights which have been given to others by God. There is a humbleness about humility which places things in perspective. To have humility is to be aware of one's faults and weaknesses. Therefore, the person of humility neither swells up with pride at the sound of praise, nor is that individual deflated when criticism comes her or his way. One cannot have humility without being immersed in submission before, in servitude to God. In fact, this submission and servitude is the fertile soil out of which the flower of humility grows. Sufi masters are very adept in showing initiates how to till the soil of servitude. Spiritual guides do this through their own beautiful example of servitude and submission. Sufi sheikhs also care for the seeds of humility, which have been planted in human beings by God. They provide spiritual nourishment and protection for the struggling seedling. In addition, spiritual guides are very skilled in helping to remove the weeds of the individual's ego, which threaten to strangle the growth of humility. In this respect, one kind of offshoot of the ego which is particularly dangerous and must be removed from the garden of the soul is the weed of false humility. The ego has a great capacity for mimicry. In order to serve its ultimate agenda, the ego can take on the external appearance of, among other things, humility. The ego can appear meek, mild, submissive, humble, respectful, and deferential. However, all of this is a self-serving act to enhance its own sense of self-aggrandizement. For example, when others comment on how humble and respectful the person of false humility is, inwardly, such a person exalts in the rays of praise extended to him or her. People of false humility live for this sort of notice and acknowledgement. For them, humility is not a spiritual issue, rather, it is an issue of ego gratification. People of false humility are very annoyed if people fail to take notice of their quote-unquote spiritual condition. Moreover, when the desired acknowledgement is not forthcoming, they tend to get moody, sullen, and withdrawn. They often feel people do not appreciate their true spiritual greatness. Differentiating between true humility and false humility can be quite difficult. To do so takes either A, the experienced eye and understanding of a Sufi sheikh, or B, the spiritual training which can be gained through the sheikh. To have humility does not mean the individual is devoid of self-esteem. However, this sense of self-worth has nothing to do with the sort of cocky confidence spoken of earlier. One has esteem for the spiritual self because it provides us with the opportunity for realizing our relationship with God. One values the spiritual self because it is a unique gift of God, which contains hidden within it a vast array of spiritual treasures, one of which is humility. This segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast, which I refer to as the It Has Been Said feature, will usually be fairly brief. It involves nothing more than a few sentences, and sometimes only one sentence, concerning what someone on the Sufi path is reported to have said at one time or another. The words are given without attribution because the purpose of presenting such thoughts is not to serve as some sort of claim to authoritativeness independent of content, but rather to put forth food for thought that can be considered independently of whomever might have made such a statement. The statements are intended to stimulate reflection. They are not intended to be statements that should be considered as being persuasive because someone of note might have said them
and which then, all too frequently, unfortunately, go on to be misunderstood and or misused by someone who is trying to impose his or her interpretation of things on others. Just consider what is being said. Don't accumulate information for purposes of argument and disputation. Let the ideas flow over your mind and heart. Let them take root there and be cultivated with care to see what fruits might arise from them that, however valuable they might be to you, should not be force-fed to others. The veil between God and you is not a matter of heaven or the earth, nor is it a matter of the throne or the footstool. Rather, your illusions and sense of selfhood are the veils. When they are removed, then the curtain of separation will disappear. The following segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is a brief prayer that is offered on behalf of whomever might have managed to survive to this portion of the program. O our Lord, help us to understand that our most hostile enemy is our own soul. O our Lord, help us to realize that there is no power and no strength save through you. O our Lord, assist us to fight against our current state of spiritual sleep and to struggle towards wakefulness. This week's edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life. You have been listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. The host for this program, namely yours truly, is neither a sheikh nor a spiritual guide, nor am I equipped to advise anyone where she or he might be able to formally step onto the Sufi path. When I stumbled into the spiritual tavern of my sheikh, I had no idea what I was doing or how I had found such an establishment. When my sheikh passed away, there were no provisions left in place for anyone else to assume his responsibilities in the future. Since his passing away, I have come to learn, in a very close-up and problematic way, that there are spiritual charlatans who are constantly trolling the waters of existence for vulnerable prey. While I believe there still are authentic spiritual guides who exist in various parts of the world, and unfortunately are becoming fewer in number, I do not have confidence in recommending this or that person as being an authentic sheikh, which is not to say that such people aren't legitimate, but rather it is to say that I do not feel comfortable in recommending them to anyone as individuals for whom I could give assurances that they are people on whom one can rely spiritually. The contents of the program are intended merely as food for thought. While such food might induce someone to want to journey beyond the very limited horizons of the podcast, please keep in mind that I am of the understanding that the Sufi path cannot be traversed without an authentic spiritual guide. And unfortunately, as indicated previously, there are many fraudulent teachers who are actively seeking opportunities to misguide people and thereby not only muddying the spiritual waters, but attempting to corrupt, if not destroy, the spiritual potential of unsuspecting people. Information concerning past editions of the Sufi Study Circle can be found by going to anab-whitehouse.com/circle, that's capital C, small I-R-C-L-E .htm. Thank you for your time, and perhaps we will convene again in the future during some further, God willing, edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast.